dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host. I am going to be escorting you in the run-up to the new year with a sort of look back as well as look ahead on events of the times and what they're doing to shape the what I think of as the battle space of the war for the free world. And one of the most important of those areas is Russia at the moment, and we're delighted to be joined once again by David Satter. I consider him to be one of the country's most perspicacious observers of what is going on there. He's a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, as well as at the School of Advanced International Studies Foreign Policy Institute. The author most recently of It Was a Long Time Ago, and It Never Happened Anyway. And also the driving force behind a movie just out, based on his earlier book, Age of Delirium. David, it's great to have you back. We spoke shortly after the elections took place last month, I believe it was, in Russia. A lot has been happening in the interval, and I'm anxious to hear what is going on at the moment. But quickly, reprise for us what we were to make of the Russian elections that were held at the parliamentary level, as I recall.
Yes, well, those elections were outrageously falsified. And the falsification was very evident to Russians at the individual polling places. The ruling party, United Russia, did not conceal the extent to which it was seeking to produce an artificial result. And finally, at least a segment of the Russian population has had enough. We are seeing the first mass demonstrations in Russia since the perestroika period. And for the first time, Putin's hold on power is becoming shaky.
Really? This is, I guess, kind of the key question. When we last visited David Satter, it seemed as though there was going to be some unpleasantness over all of this, but that nothing could jeopardize the seemingly permanent hold that Vladimir Putin has developed over the years on power in the Kremlin. Is it your judgment now that things may actually be reaching such a point where that is in fact in question?
I think it's very much in question, because the hold on power of Putin and his entourage was always very superficial. The point is that they showed no restraint in their stealing. And they created a system that was corrupt from top to bottom, in which there was total lawlessness. And people kind of reconciled themselves to that situation as long as the standard of living kept improving. You have to bear in mind, in understanding the situation in Russia, that Russians have waited for decades for an improvement in their material conditions. They've long dreamed of living like Europeans, and Russia was always a very poor country with a very low standard of living. Under Putin, for the first time, many people began to taste a real improvement in their material conditions, and this bought Putin a lot of popularity and a lot of time. But I think his time has run out for a couple of reasons. First of all, the boom of the 2000s has pretty much played out, and growth rates are a lot lower now. At the same time, people become accustomed to a higher standard of living. It's very easy to become accustomed to good conditions. This is one of our problems in the United States, is that people take for granted all the good things we have in this country.
Yes,
and don't realize
that
they can be different. Well, the same psychological mechanism is now beginning to manifest itself in Russia. People are beginning to become accustomed to a more comfortable style of life, and as a result, they're beginning to ask themselves why they don't have freedoms, why they don't have the protection of law, why they don't have the ability to live without corruption.
Right, why the kleptocrats and, are running the place.
And David Satter, why should a small group of kleptocrats run a huge country?
Yeah, and we're also hearing from the current president, soon to be presumably premier, Medvedev, that in his State of the Union, or State of the Nation, I guess they call it, address, some reforms really do need to be made. Is this too little too late, or is it really a direct reflection of what's happening, and will it make a difference?
It's a direct reflection of what's happening, and it will make a difference, but I think not the difference that the authorities intend. I think what they're hoping to do is to contain the protests, to assure civil society that after all things aren't so bad, that that people have some influence, to diffuse the tension, to make it possible to let off steam. But a more likely result is that that these long overdue changes will only whet people's appetite for a genuine democratic system. And these changes are being made not with a view to moving Russia toward democracy, but rather with a view to containing the protests.
Keeping a lid on things. Yeah, and keeping a lid on things. And David Satter, they're talking about direct election of governors and anti-nepotism rules and I guess an independent public television network. This seems like fairly thin gruel, even if what you're trying to do is just, somewhat contain the pressure for change. Is there more to it than that? And is there any likelihood that you will see the public accepting this as sufficient for the present time and sticking with the Putin program?
Well, this is the only tactic that has some hope of working, because I don't think in the long run that mass repression will work either. The problem here is that by eliminating the most outrageous of the abuses, I mean, after all, this is a country that constantly refers to itself as the Russian Federation, and yet in this so-called federation, the governors are appointed by the president. I mean, that's not much of a federation. By making some of these changes, they're only going to highlight the extent to which people still live under a kleptocratic rule, that there's no justice, and that those in power are stealing as if there was no tomorrow. And I don't think it's going to work. The only thing they're counting on, I believe, is that it will give people an excuse for further passivity. But my guess is that the days of kind of leaden passivity are gone.
Well, let's hope so, David Satter. There's been quite a tradition of it, I guess, over the many centuries of the Russian czars and so on. But let's talk, if I can, bring this home to us. Interested as we are, of course, in the plight of the Russian people, David Satter of the Hudson Institute, what do you think are the implications for U.S.-Russian relations as this kind of turmoil persists, if it does?
Well, one tactic, of course, is very likely to be accusing the United States of interference, trying to rally xenophobic and nationalistic sentiments.
Putin has already done some of that, hasn't he? With
he
Hillary
already
Clinton?
Has. Yeah, he accused Hillary Clinton of being responsible for the demonstrations,
right.
Although it's her State Department that authorized the reset policy.
Right.
So there's an irony in that. But
indeed.
Nonetheless, there are many potential points of conflict, and similarly conflict with Georgia and with the neighboring states could all be used to try to distract the attention of the population from the corruption of their rulers.
Well, as you have done so much to document, David Satter, with the Chechen campaign in the very first instance that was central to Putin's coming to power. We have to leave it at this. David, I trust that in 2012 we will have a chance to visit with you frequently. I fear it may be because there's a lot to assess and understand about what's going on in Russia in the days ahead. We look to you, as always, for great counsel in that regard. Thank you for the new book. It was a long time ago, and it never happened anyway. Russia and the Communist Past, and also congratulations once again on the new film, Age of Delirium. David Satter will be visiting with you again very soon. Next up, we'll be talking with Ryan Morrow about Syria and Iraq and what's coming next. Straight ahead.
First line of defense in the war of ideas, Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of 3 children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a 5th grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a 5-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit shariathethreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, the Threat to America at amazon.com.
Congress doesn't have a budget for 2011, but the GOP has proposed a budget for 2012, and Bill Bennett likes it.
Maybe it helps to have that 2012 in the background, people hearing and seeing Ryan and the Republicans saying they're serious about really cutting the budget
as a backdrop
to this debate about 2011. People make the decision, well, Republicans seem much more serious about this.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined by Ryan Morrow. I consider him to be one of the brighter young stars in the firmament of the foreign policy analysis team. He is the founder of WorldThreats.com. And a national security analyst for Christian Action Network. He graces our program from time to time to talk about events that I know he's covering intensively, one of which is what is happening in Syria at the moment. And Ryan, it seems as though there's a lot going on there, and I'm very anxious to get your take on it. We've had a suicide bombing in Damascus recently. Some say that that's the work of Al-Qaeda. We have Arab League monitors on the ground, attacks on the city of Homs. Give us an up-to-the-moment report, if you would, on who's on first in Syria at the moment, and then we'll get into what you expect others to do about it.
Well,
Right now, the big news is that the Arab League humanitarian observers have arrived. Bashar Assad has finally allowed them to come into the country in order to survey the damage and see what's going on. Obviously, it's going to be a show. Everything that they show the Arab League observers is going to be staged. In fact, today, the Assad regime's tanks withdrew from Homs, which is really the center of the revolution right now, right before the Arab League observers arrive. And then as soon as they leave, they'll go back to blowing the place up. Assad has also moved the political prisoners from prison to prison so that the observers don't come in contact with them and can see how they're being tortured and brutalized, including children, according to some reports, as young as 11 or 12 years old being put in prison. So this is a very brutal regime, and last week was the bloodiest week in Syria since the revolution began in around February. So the situation continues to spiral downwards. It continues to get more violent. And I think the more, as that happens more and more often, it becomes more likely that you're going to see outside intervention by Turkey and some other Arabs and some Arab states.
Well, let's come to that in a moment. But Ryan Morrow, we're then given to believe that this Arab League exercise will be pretty much a Potemkin village, as they say, that they will not be allowed to interface with the citizens of Syria and get a really accurate picture of what's been happening. They'll see what the regime wants them to see and not much more, and that'll be it. Do you think that will be satisfactory to them?
No, I don't, actually. The Arab League is taking for the Arab League, they're taking a hard stance on Syria. And that's because the political pressure is just immense. You have that if you're a secular Democrat, you want the Assad regime gone. If you are an Islamist like the Muslim Brotherhood or a Salafist, you want the regime gone. And so you have all these different components of society in the Arab world coming together against Bashar Assad. So the governments of the Arab world are really being pressured to take a hardline stance. In fact, Hamas is pretty much left Damascus because the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood, the Muslim Brotherhood being Hamas's parent organization, is on the side of the opposition, and so Hamas has been caught between a rock and a hard place where they have to choose between Iran and Syria, their longtime backers, and their Muslim Brotherhood brethren, and it looks like they're choosing their Muslim Brotherhood brethren.
Yeah. And speaking of Iran, Ryan Morrow, what is the current state of play with respect to Iran? It has had a proxy relationship with the Hafez Assad regime for years. Is it giving up on him as well, or are they still trying to prop him up and keep him a going concern?
The Iranian regime is doubling down on its support for Bashar Assad. So is Hezbollah. The Iranians have activated an air bridge where there's about 7 flights each week on Iranian commercial airliners to Damascus that deliver weapons. There's legitimate passengers on board that don't realize that they're sitting on top of weapons that are going to be used to kill the Syrian people. Just today I saw a report that a whole bunch of Iranian, well, what the Syrians are calling technicians, but we know that they're not really technicians, have been kidnapped in Syria, in Homs. So that indicates that the Syrian defectors located the Iranians that are on the ground helping Assad crush the uprising, and they took him out.
And Hezbollah, of course, would not be a surprise that it does what Iran says. It's, of course, itself a client of Iran. But its position in Lebanon depends critically upon the Assad regime remaining a going concern, at least it has to date. Do you expect if one or the other of these alternatives to the Assad regime actually come to power, that position would be jeopardized in Lebanon?
I think that's definitely true. Even if a Sunni Islamist government comes to power, I don't think that you're going to see as many resources devoted from the Syrian population to Hezbollah just out of being pragmatic politically. The Syrian people wouldn't go for that. So I think that this is a very bad situation for Hezbollah, which is why Hezbollah is doing everything it can to keep Bashar Assad in power. In the head of the Syrian National Council, which is the umbrella group of the Syrian opposition groups right now, actually said that if it comes to power, it promises it will cut off Syria's alliance with Iran, Hamas, and Hezbollah. Now, that was said by its secular leader. As we know, in Libya, it's very possible for the Islamists to come to power and then kick that guy to the side, but that's still a positive statement.
Yeah, it is a positive statement, but I do fear that that's exactly what's going to happen, that the secularists will be pushed over the side, not just to it. Let's turn quickly, Ryan Morrow, before we run out of time with you, to what's happening in Iraq. The United States, since we last talked, of course, has completed its withdrawal from Iraq. We are witnessing a great ferment on the ground, including new and very violent attacks. What's happening in your estimation, and what do you think is likely to come of it?
Well, it seems like the second U.S. forces completed their pullout from Iraq, the Sunni and Shiite political classes are at each other's throats. The average Iraqi Sunni and Shiite don't hate each other and don't want anything to do with this, but when it comes to politics, it becomes a rougher game. And so the Shiite Prime Minister al-Maliki is accusing the Sunni vice president, who is affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood, of being behind a terrorist plot to kill him. So there really is a political crisis, and that's causing violence within Iraq. One of the things that we need to look for is that starting January 1st, Muqtada al-Sadr, the Iranian-backed cleric, says that he is going to revive his militia to target any American presence remaining in Iraq. That doesn't just isn't limited to the soldiers that are guarding the embassy. That also includes the thousands of American contractors that remain in Iraq. So get ready for it. You're going to see Muqtada al-Sadr burst onto the scene soon, and he's going to try to kill every American remaining in Iraq.
This is a character that we, of course, confronted while we were there. Were, I believe, our forces instrumental in defeating him. The extent to which he went off to Iran and rebuilt his capabilities and is now back helped to create conditions under which, as you know, Ryan Morrow, the United States felt obliged to leave. Play that scenario out for us, Muqtada al-Sadr going after our contractors and perhaps our embassy, presumably with the strong support and maybe the assistance of his Iranian sponsors. Does this give rise, in your estimation, to a prospect of perhaps another Iranian takeover of another embassy, this one the U.S. vast complex in Baghdad?
I think it's very possible. If anyone would be able and willing to do it, it would be Muqtada al-Sadr. Imagine what happens if these contractors defend themselves and they kill an Iraqi. Think about the uproar that's going to be staged by Iran and al-Sadr and their friends. And already we're hearing rumors that the Sunnis are going to try and create their own autonomous region in Iraq. I think it's very possible that you'll see the Sunnis, in fear of what al-Sadr would do to them, will revive their own militias. And so I don't think that we're going to go back to the 2006 levels of sectarian warfare without something really major happening. I think it would take a lot to push Iraqis in that direction now. They've rejected that course. But at the same time, you could see very much a sectarian divide within Iraq that plays to Iran's advantage. The Iranians would absolutely love that, and they'd love to see al-Sadr become the leader of the Iraqi Shiites. Because then that means Iran is the leader of the Iraqi Shiites.
Yeah. Boy, I hope you're right. It doesn't return to that level of violence. I fear it may well, especially if nature seems as it is now taking its course. Ryan, in 20 seconds, what's your estimation? Is history likely to judge Barack Obama as having lost Iraq?
I think that's definitely very possible. The effort to keep U.S. forces there and get an arrangement with the Iraqi government was delayed. It wasn't done very well. For all the talk of President Obama's diplomatic initiatives, this is not a very bright spot. And so I think in the coming months, you're going to see a lot of people, especially Iraqis who have to live under this, upset with President Obama's position on this.
I think a lot of Americans will be, too, if it turns out that what we've invested in lives and treasure is all for naught. Ryan Morrow, founder of WorldThreats.com and National Security Analyst for Christian Action Network. Thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to doing more of it in 2012. Happy New Year to you and all the best. Next up, we'll be speaking with Reza Khalili about Iran and where it's headed. Straight ahead.
To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hey, parents. Finding it hard to communicate with kids in today's world of ever-changing slang?
Hi, son.
Excuse me?
Introducing the Communicizer. Just strap non-toxic Communicizer to your mouth and go from boring old man speak.
Oh, you know, I'm here if you want to talk.
To 100% off the chain.
Text me with numbers, yo.
It's that easy.
Thanks to Communicizer, I'm relevant to my kids again. I mean, I'll fly, boo.
And now when you buy Communicizer, you get the auto-tune attachment free. Sounds so hip-hop, your kids will want to talk to you for hours.
I used to have to walk 3 miles uphill to school every morning, shorty.
I love you, Dad.
I love you too, son.
Communicizer is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
For decades, the Democratic Republic of Congo has endured economic collapse, poverty, and war. More than 3.5 million people have died in the conflict. Today, rebel forces continue to wreak havoc in the eastern Kivu provinces. The International Rescue Committee estimates that 30,000 children have been recruited as soldiers, and thousands more have lost their parents. Most of these children lack the most basic level of goods, security, and most especially, clean drinking water. Yet, there is a well of hope coming to eastern Congo in a village called Uvira. Washington, D.C.'s National Community Church is partnering with Global Outreach to bring a water pipeline to the Congo for Christ compound, an orphanage for children who have lost their parents to war and AIDS. Building a clean water source will sustain the school, provide for the children, and hundreds more in the village. Go to www.waterforcongo.com. Learn about the work of Global Outreach and give. You can be part of the community in Uvira, and like a well, you can be a source of hope in life. www.waterforcongo.com.
Hi, I'm Drew Brees, NFL quarterback for the New Orleans Saints, here with Bugs Bunny to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you fuel your body and your mind.
So what do you like to throw around the football like Drew?
Skateboard.
Play frisbee in the park.
Ride a bike.
Kick the soccer ball around.
Or dance in your room.
Just move it your way.
Because nothing makes you feel better than moving every day.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
So be a player.
You'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
Move it your way and be a player.
Get up and play an hour a day, Doc. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
That's right, at letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
I'll pick you up after school. Okay, I got it.
It's easy to take a day for granted. You and your family are connected by routine, and you stick to it. But what if a disaster strikes without warning? What if life as you know it has completely turned on its head? What if your day's routine is disrupted and you can't reach your family? Have you planned for that? Before a disaster turns your family's world upside down, it's up to you to be ready. Get a kit, make a plan, be informed today. Learn how at www.ready.gov. Ready.gov. This message brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are joined by Reza Khalili. He is using that as a pseudonym to obscure his identity as a former Iranian Revolutionary Guard member who worked undercover at great personal risk as an agent for the CIA for several years in the 1980s and 1990s. He has brought to the rest of us some of his experiences in that capacity and some of his insights about the nature of the Iranian regime and what it is up to in his best-selling book, A Time to Betray, The Astonishing Double Life of a CIA Agent Inside the Revolutionary Guard, of Iran. Reza Khalili, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's great to have you with us. Happy New Year to you.
Oh, thank you so much, and Happy New Year to you.
Thank you. Listen, I'd like to start with a story that has not gotten a whole lot of attention, even though it seems to me it's of enormous significance. And that is that a federal judge in the Southern District of New York, just before Christmas, issued a ruling to the effect that Iran, along with al-Qaeda and the Taliban, must be held liable for the 9/11 attacks, and that, in fact, it is continuing to collaborate with al-Qaeda. This flies in the face, of course, of a lot of what is, I guess, conventional wisdom, Reza Khalili, that Sunnis and Shia never collaborate. The Sunnis of al-Qaeda and the Shia of Iran wouldn't do such a thing. Give us your sense, as a man who'd worked inside the belly of the beast, as to whether you find this to be true, this ruling, and is as much of a surprise as I think it must be to a lot of others.
You see, the collaboration between the guards and al-Qaeda, the Iranian regime and al-Qaeda, goes back actually to the 80s. Right after the Islamic Revolution, they established ties with many factions, including the Islamic Jihad in Egypt and other radical factions. And then Mr. Ahmad Rahim, who is the current defense minister of Iran, and by the way, he's wanted by the Interpol for his involvement in the Jewish Community Center bombing in Buenos Aires, Argentina. He established ties with Ayman al-Zawahiri, who was involved with the Egyptian Islamic Jihad, an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood. Zawahiri later emerged the jihad forces with bin Laden, and they were constantly in contact, and under the leadership of Mr. Vahidi, Iran provided a safe transit for the movement of al-Qaeda forces and actually facilitated the group in their ultimate planning for 9/11. And I reported this right after 9/11 that there was a strange behavior by the Iranian agent within U.S. Right before 9/11, which I interpreted to be that they were quite aware of the incident. So I'm not surprised by the ruling. And the Iranian regime, the regime in Iran, the radical regime in Iran, has been the head of all terrorism worldwide, and this is part of it.
Yeah. This is a stunning affirmation, and I appreciate very much you sharing it with us, Reza Khalili. Let's talk a little bit about some of the other things that Iran is up to at the moment. I'm among those, and I think you are as well, who believe that Iran has been at war with the United States and the West more generally since at least the late 1970s. Give us a sense. We're hearing about plots to attack the Saudi ambassador here, cyber attacks against American facilities, the cross-border smuggling, tie-ins with drug cartels, the connections with Hugo Chavez and others in our hemisphere, the threats to the Strait of Hormuz. To what extent does all of this signal that the Iranian regime is not only at war with us, but is increasingly ratcheting up that warfare against us?
This is a great question, because the Iranian regime has been at war with U.S. ever since the Islamic Revolution, and they've been expanding their activities. And we're going to note here two key factors. One is that they stand, the Islamic rulers of Iran, stand against every principle of Western civilization. So there is no particular animosity towards U.S. or Israel or this. They just want us dead because Islam orders them to do so. They're true believers of this.
Sorry.
Now, the second key factor here is that as long as they feel immune with their actions, they're going to become much more aggressive, and this has been their behavior throughout the past three decades. We have done nothing against their actions, such as the Marine Barracks bombing and many other acts of terrorism, and now it's all coming to a head with them acquiring the nuclear bomb, threatening world stability and global economy and coming out with a specific threat that they're going to close down their Strait of Hormuz even if we apply the sanctions against their oil exports. And so they've become very brazen, very aggressive, believing that U.S. is weak, that it cannot act, and that the whole global economy plays into their advantage. And just imagine if they can do this now, what they'll be able to do with a nuclear bomb.
A frightening thought, needless to say. We're speaking again with Reza Khalili. He is the author of a tremendously important book entitled A Time to Betray, The Astonishing Double Life of a CIA Agent Inside the Revolutionary Guard of Iran. Reza, you are following closely what is happening inside your homeland. Tell us what we should make of the various things that clearly are unsettling to the regime, explosions at a missile facility and a nuclear research center, the assassinations of nuclear scientists, the Stuxnet worm. We're hearing a lot about internal struggles. What should we make of it? And are these symptoms of a kind of stressing of the system that might actually prevent some of what you've just described from coming to pass?
Despite the strength they're showing on the outside, despite their aggressive posture and a message that they are unified and they're going to be confronting any aggression, within the Islamic regime, there are wide cracks right now. And more so within the very force that has been the support of this regime ever since the Islamic Revolution, and that's the Revolutionary Guards. Many are disenchanted with the regime. Many are even being suppressed right now, just as the same as the Iranian people are. And so there's been many changes within the Guards command. Every day they replace one commander here and there. Many have been arrested due to this recent explosion at the Guards facility, because at that time Khamenei and others were supposed to be present, so they interpreted this as someone within the regime who informed the outside forces for the covert activity. So there is a lot going on right now with covert operation in Iran, with the hope that we can stop this regime from acquiring the nuclear bomb, with the hope of changing the regime. But if we fall short, the consequences would be great, and therefore we need to take immediate action and help the Iranian people, because the only solution for the world terrorism and this imminent danger is a regime change in Iran.
Yes. Reza Khalili, very quickly, we have less than a minute. Who is responsible for these covert operations? Is the United States engaged in them? Is it the Israelis? Is it coming from within Iran itself?
But I think the West is unified in that. This is my belief, that Israelis are at the forefront and U.S. is also involved. And this is just my opinion. And I believe they're doing their best. These people are doing their best to stop this killing machine that's ruling the Iranian people. And we can only pray that they'll be successful.
Yes. Well, praying is indeed critical to the task at hand. Reza Khalili has been our guest, and I know you are a source of wisdom on this subject and can help in targeting those prayers. Follow what Reza Khalili is writing at atimetobetray.com. You can also find from there and elsewhere his writings about what is going on in Iran and what it means to the rest of us. Reza Khalili, we appreciate so much your joining us this time and in the past in 2011. We look forward to visiting with you again soon in 2012.
Thank you so much for having me, and God bless.
Thank you. Next up, we'll be speaking with Gordon Chang, our update on China and the look ahead to 2012. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I went from a size 18 down to a size 5, and I was able to keep it off.
Angie had some serious challenges.
I had gone through a divorce and put on quite a bit of weight. There was an accident where I was put on a lot of medication, and I put on over 60 pounds. I tried every kind of diet. The diets just did not work.
Diets don't work is something they hear a lot over at the MetaSystem from Judy Singer.
I heard about Judy Singer's MetaSystem, and I thought, well, you know, couldn't hurt to call. And I called them up, and they told me all about the product, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. From the first week that I was on it, I wasn't hungry a lot, and it was just amazing. Jumping about 3 months ahead, I dropped 63 pounds.
If you're ready for a natural product that cleanses your system and helps you lose fat, talk to a Judy Singer counselor about the MetaSystem. Call 1-800-711-JUDY. 1-800-711-JUDY. The MetaSystem from Judy Singer. Powerful, all-natural weight loss. 1-800-711-JUDY.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of 3 children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a 5th grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a 5-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Is Nancy Pelosi looking to a higher power to get a balanced budget? Hugh Hewitt sets her straight.
When I hear you speak about this issue, of course, it's the Gospel of Matthew. When I was hungry, you begged me to eat and
listen. I just got to stop here. Nancy Pelosi quoting the Gospel of Matthew, as though that's got anything to do with the government. Let me just tell you, it doesn't.
Can I get an amen?
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC, new choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need, and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff,
like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined as we have the privilege of being each week by Gordon Chang, our duty expert on Asia. He is also the go-to guy for Forbes.com and World Affairs Journal and Fox News and many, many more. The author of important books on the region, including The Coming Collapse of China. And Gordon, you wrote a while back about North Korea taking on the world. Let's start with what North Korea seems to be doing at the moment. Obviously, it is mourning the demise of its longtime leader, Kim Jong-il. But
Give us a bit of the backstory on what's happening there and what we think might come out of it in 2012.
What we're seeing right now is really a lot of choreography. Kim Jong-il, before he died, apparently tried to lay out the steps that would occur after his death, and that's what we're seeing right now. So, for instance, Kim Jong-un, his designated successor and youngest acknowledged son, has stepped into the role of being the supreme commander, as they say. And we've seen the military and the party close ranks around Kim Jong-un. That's to be expected, but the real issue is what's going to happen afterwards. The problem here is that Kim Jong-un has had only 2 years, really, as the designated successor, and so he hasn't had the time to put his people into critical posts in the party, and he hasn't learned how to operate what is in reality a very complex regime. So, for instance, he doesn't know how to balance the various factions that constitute this government, the military, security services, and the party. He's going to need a lot of help, and the odds are that he's just not going to make it.
Yeah. This is a guy who's, as I understand it, maybe 28 years old, Gordon Chang. Do you think he has his people? Is it possible that he could have developed enough of a cohort of loyal followers that he would be able to turn to and put into key positions to cover his backside?
I don't think that he has had a chance to do that. His father appointed his own sister, Kim Kwang-hee, and her husband, Jun Song-tak, to be the sort of regents for Kim Jong-un, his son. And his regents, though, are very interesting people. They're ambitious on their own. They might try to get rid of Kim Jong-un in one way or another, or just to make him a figurehead. And the other thing that's critical is that the regents are people who have a lot of enemies in the military, who really are the military is the most powerful institution in the country. So there's a real problem here for Kim Jong-un in that the people who are supposed to protect him give him a bit of trouble with the folks who really hold the whip hand right now. So, you know, Kim Jong-un may survive as a figurehead, but I don't think that there's really going to be much more than that. And he's got to worry about his eldest brother, Kim Jong-nam, who seems to be protected by the Chinese these days. So this gets to be very, very Byzantine.
Yes, it does. To add to the complexity further, Gordon Chang, you have written in World Affairs Journal a provocative piece suggesting that quite apart from the internecine Byzantine behavior of the folks in Pyongyang, that you might actually see communist China absorbing North Korea. Tell us what your theory there is and how could that be accomplished?
Well, China has always been looking at the Koreans as vassals. And if North Korea, for instance, breaks into, you know, starts to disintegrate because the regime members start fighting among themselves, which is a real possibility a year from now, then we could see Chinese troops cross the border and absolutely absorb parts of Korea. This is maybe not
so
the most likely.
So it would be an actual invasion in force.
That's a real possibility if China feels that the security situation in North Korea is no longer acceptable. The Chinese don't want to do this, but nonetheless, they're prepared to, because they had talks with the Koreans in the past about basing elements of the People's Liberation Army in North Korea to protect Chinese investments. So it's not too large of a jump to believe that the Chinese military might actually also cross the border. This is important because, going back to Kim Jong-nam, he used to live in Macau, and it's very interesting, Macau being a part of China. Kim Jong-nam was always at the risk of assassination, yet Kim Jong-nam walked around Macau without bodyguards. And the question is, how could he do that? Well, I think the only way he could have done that is if the Chinese told Kim Jong-il to leave him alone, not to try to kill him. And I think the reason the Chinese did this is because they thought that maybe they might insert him into Pyongyang in the future if they wanted a puppet government there. And now, to add to all the intrigue, Kim Jong-nam, since the death of his father, has disappeared, and he's believed to be in Beijing under Chinese protection.
Wow. Well, we turn to you, Gordon Chang, to try to sort this out, and we will certainly be turning to you in the future to try to make sure that we have as much clarity as one can about this kind of machination that's taking place. And you know, who's doing what to whom in North Korea? It has potentially quite far-reaching implications, as you know better than just about anybody. Speaking of China, Gordon Chang, let me ask you about a piece that you've written We talked in an earlier hour-long segment, which I really commend to everybody, at some length about what's going on in China. But there was an interesting report you did recently for your Forbes.com column about a Chinese gentleman who is at the moment the World Bank's chief economist and a kind of campaign, as you put it, that he's mounting. Tell us what he's up to and why is he saying what he's saying?
Justin Lin, or Justin Lin Yifu, is the World Bank chief economist, as you mentioned. He is the guy who's followed in the footsteps of people like Larry Summers and Joe Stiglitz. And since basically the end of November, he's been on this campaign to convince the world that China's economy is okay. And so he's making predictions that China can continue to grow at 8% for 20 more years. Yes, China has grown at 9.9% for three decades, but I think the Chinese economy has hit an inflection point. And I believe that Justin Lin, who has really been a spokesman for the Chinese government in effect before he became World Bank chief economist, really is I think, trying to take people and sort of shake them away from the pessimism that they now have about what's going on inside the Chinese economy. Because you see the hedge fund community, the investment community, even the foreign business community starting to question the Chinese miracle, quote unquote. And I think that Justin Lin is part of Beijing's effort to create a little bit of optimism about the direction of the Chinese economy.
So it could be simply a guy who has long been a flack for communist China, essentially pushing out the party line out of China, the kind of disinformation despite the prestigious position that he holds and the supposed independence that would go with it at the World Bank?
Yeah. Justin Lin said that he's looking forward to an Asian century. Well, first of all, Asia is not the only constituent part of the World Bank. The World Bank is supposed to look at the rest of the world. So that's one problem I have with Justin Lin. But also because he doesn't, you know, the reasons he put forth for why China can do this really don't make sense. You know, essentially the Chinese economy right now is facing some real important headwinds. You know, people talk about the environment. People talk about the global situation in Europe causing problems for China. You look at issues of demography, overinvestment. There are so many problems that China right now is facing. And so what Justin Lin says really doesn't make sense. He thinks that China can follow in the footsteps of Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan in exporting their way to prosperity, but that doesn't really compute because there are not enough consumers in the world to have China grow at 8%, because China is so much larger than those countries were, and those countries started exporting a long time ago. We've gotten well beyond that with a very troubled global economic environment that is not going to permit China to export its way to prosperity, despite what Justin Lin thinks.
Gordon, we've got a minute left. Very quickly, amplify just a minute, if you would, on the inflection point and what it will mean for us as well as the Chinese in 2012.
Since the end of September, the Chinese economy indicators have been crumbling. It means that I think China's going to face a very difficult 2012. U.S. will be okay because we don't really need China as much as they need us. They have an economy geared to selling things to us. We could do just fine without them. We can buy our stuff from elsewhere. We can manufacture it at home.
Well, that's the kind of upbeat assessment that we don't often get from you, Gordon, but we're delighted to have on this occasion of wrapping up 2011 and looking forward, among other things, to having the opportunity to take stock again with you early and often in 2012. Happy New Year to you and your family. Keep up the terrific work that you do at Forbes and World Journal and World Affairs Journal, and keep coming back to us. And to the rest of you, I say thank you for joining us as well. We'll talk with you again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.